Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special free preview for this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie. And this month's What a Cartoon Movie is Tiny Toon Adventures, How I Spent My Vacation. I am one of your hosts for this one, Bob Mackey, who's here with me today.
Just a little loony, Henry Gilbert. Hey, boy, and I am a little loony after talking for 3.5 hours about Tiny Toons.
Yes, it's another one of our mega-sized movie podcasts we do every month for people at the $10 tier at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
We do feature-length movies, and we give them a feature-length podcast when we talk about them, double as long as our normal What a Cartoons. And this one, we go deep into the history of one of the most important animated series in American history, I dare say.
And it's never looked better or been funnier than in this direct-to-video movie. It is so glorious, and we talked about it for, again, 3.5 hours. We go into the history of Tiny Toons, the history of this production, and then do a beat-by-beat breakdown of the movie with our normal clips and references treatment.
Mm-hmm. Tons of fun. I learned a ton of stuff about the production of the show and about multiple of the major names on it specifically. I learned a ton about Sherry Stoner that I didn't know before. Like, she's a really cool person. Everybody talks about there's not enough women in animation. She was a leader in women animating stuff in the 90s that I think kind of gets forgotten a little bit.
Yes, and in this free preview, you'll hear a little bit about the history of Tiny Toons. And if you subscribe again at the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, you'll unlock all of our previous What a Cartoon Movie podcast. We've done things like Kiki's Delivery Service, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, Akira, Secret of Nim, and so much more. A Goofy Movie. Now there are getting too many to list.
Too many to list. It used to be, I feel like a parent looking at their child, like, used to be so small, and now I can't list every one of you.
Now you're off to college again. Yes. But yes, we have so much going on behind the paywall. And if you sign up for the $10 level, you get all of our $5 rewards too. Too many podcasts to mention here, but you'll get all of our exclusive miniseries, all of our interviews, our end of show wrap-ups, our monthly community podcast, and so much more on top of that. It's a lot for your money, and we'd like to provide you a lot for your money. But these are our longest podcasts, and we do them every month, and patrons vote on which ones we do.
Yes, and if you're a $5 and up patron, you can jump up to the $10 level, and these old podcasts will show up in your feed, in your old classic RSS feed, so it's really easy to jump up to the $10 level and get access to all that stuff, plus all of the old video content that we did before we started the What a Cartoon Movie podcast. You'll get access to that too on top of it. It's gravy on top of it.
Yes, we've done a lot of video commentaries, including video commentaries for all of the Tracy Ullman Show Simpsons shorts. You can watch all of those with us giving you all the information that you need to know over those weird shorts.
Mm-hmm. But so, without further ado, why don't we get a little taste of summer here and listen to a chunk of the history of how Tiny Toon Adventures came to get on our TV. Warner Animation hires Gene McCurdy, straight out of Marvel Productions, to oversee their new big studio expansion. And very quickly, she teamed up with Amblin and Steven Spielberg, trying to figure out what he wanted to do. And they both agreed that they wanted something in the spirit of Looney Tunes, but also to hit the corporate demands of baby-fied Looney Tunes in a Muppet Baby style, because that is highly commercial in 1989, or for a thing that's going to premiere in 1990. And so McCurdy remembers how well Ruger was handling Pup Named Scooby-Doo at her old stomping grounds of Hanna-Barbera. So as Tom tells it, in January of 1989, she called him on the phone, and this is paraphrasing, but saying, like, do you want to have a meeting with Steven Spielberg about a new show you could do? And he quit Hanna-Barbera that day.
Oh, my God.
Just like, yes, I will do this.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah. And so Spielberg, McCurdy, and Ruger were in agreement that they wanted a show that was reverent of Warner history while still making it some of its own. And Ruger recalls that the first rule of the show was keep Steven happy, because Spielberg hadn't worked with any of these animation folks before, and he'd be right to be worried of, like, I don't know, you new guys, you might completely fuck up my vision, or you'll just ruin this thing. Like, Steven Spielberg is old enough to have had a lot of projects by this point already fall apart.
Yeah, the weirdness of Freakazoid, check out our past episode on that, is all due to the keep Steven happy principle, where they had this pitch for an action show that they were going to make. He's like, oh, make it funny. Yeah. It's a comedy show now. We're making a comedy show. Make it funny.
And Sherry Stoner, who was one of the first hires to Tiny Toons, she talked about how Steven Spielberg was incredibly involved for a guy who at the same time was planning Jurassic Park. Like, he was in pre-production on Jurassic Park, but they sent him, scripts, and he's like, okay, I'll get the script back to you at 8, which Sherry Stoner says that completely spoiled her for script notes because they take months to come back in most television production. Like, she worked for Disney after this, and I think she learned it doesn't move as fast. She's not to skip too far ahead, but Sherry Stoner sounds like she had a similar thing to the Simpsons writers of signing an overall deal with Disney, though she produced more stuff. Like, she's a co-writer on the Casper movie that had Christina Ricci in it.
Oh, really? Okay.
But anyway, yeah, so Ruger is working hard to make Steven happy, and they're facing a ton of restrictions if they want it to star Bugs Bunny, even a young Bugs Bunny. So they realized that they need to change gears and create Tiny Toons, which originally was pitched as T-U-N-E-S to fit Looney Tunes, which would then be changed to 2 O's. They were going to create separate characters from the Warner characters, but obviously inspired with analogs to the original ones, but they are not related to them. Which let them have way more freedom than they probably would have had before with those iconic Warner characters. Like, whenever Bugs appears on screen or Daffy, you should know it comes with so many rules from Warner up top about what Bugs Bunny can say or do.
I was thinking about the spelling of Toons, and you're right, it is T-O-O-N. Mm-hmm. Was that from Roger Rabbit, where Toon was kind of like a slur in that movie?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Toontown, yes, yeah. The older you get, the more you realize, like, that the Toons are like Chinatown or other, you know, niche areas where people who are exploited minorities live and are faced with a lot of distrust and hate.
Yeah. But that word just became just the term for any animated character, a toon.
It's just a fun way to shorten cartoons.
The great cartoon Bonkers used it.
Yeah, yes. I think maybe it also proliferated so much because neither Disney nor Warner had the foresight to copyright it.
Yeah,
and so everybody so much. Call it that. With Marvel and DC, they share the copyright on the word superhero, so that nobody else can say it. That almost sounds illegal, right? The two corporations can agree
it's
to a copyright to
block
it. It's
like price fixing or something. Yeah. Insider trading.
Well, if it was illegal, they'd be punished. I know that. So. So those guys come up with a bunch of characters, which I could name myself, but why don't I let the opening of the show name them?
So here's at the Acres, it's a whole wide world apart. Our home sweet home stands alone, a cartoon work of art.
The scripts were rejected, expect the unexpected.
A Tiny Toon Adventures is about to start.
They're furry, they're funny.
They're Baz and Buster Bunny. Much hair on Max has money. Elmira is a pain. He's hunting and plucky. Dizzy devil yucky. Her balls are yucky.
Oh God, it's gonna be my head for another for another 50 years.
I apologize to all you listeners. But
man, like, naming just every character, they were so confident up front, like, you will get to know all of these.
Which, and it did, like, it really, they strike you so much because they're just like these neon colors just busting out of the screen at you. Like, they, when you put the casts next to each other of Animaniacs and Tiny Toons, Tiny Toons does draw your eye much more because they're all ridiculous colors.
It's way more 80s in that way, but yeah. I kind of like how just over the top all the color choices are, especially like things like Dizzy Devil and Buster and Babs are these like unnatural shades of whatever.
Yeah, that your two main characters are bright blue and bright pink, plus a bright green duck. Like, yeah, everybody's just crazy in that. So yes, Ruger hired a lot of folks who worked with him on Pup Named Scooby-Doo, including his old buddy Glenn Kennedy, as well as a writing staff of veterans that would include Paul Dini, Tom Minton, Wayne Katz, Nicholas Hollander, and also story editor / writer Sherry Stoner, one of the most prolific writers of the series. Sherry, she wrote almost more episodes than anybody with a writing credit on there. And they were all going to do these loony-like stories that were about going to school and growing up and having part-time jobs, but also that were fun twists on classic Looney Tunes shorts. But I think they even had more fun with just direct parodies of TV and movie and commercials. Like, that's usually when they were at their best, I think.
It wouldn't be quite as Anything Goes as Animaniacs would, but there is something to grab onto. There's a reality of the world they're in. Mm-hmm.
Well, and they're constantly breaking the fourth wall, talking to camera, even more than, you know, obviously Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. They always talk to the audience. They put up the screwball sign or duck amuck that we did is all that. But this is, they do it way more often in Tiny Toons than they did in the classic Loonies.
I just remember almost every episode, they just say hello to you when the show starts. Yeah.
Well, they welcome you to a themed episode. Yeah. Like, today's theme is this. And one of my favorites in rewatching it was the Wheel of Comedy one, which won their earliest episodes, where they kind of apologize, like, oh, it's a furball episode, yay. Like, they knew there were, it was the writer speaking, like, I didn't want to do a furball sketch. I'm sorry.
I mean, this movie, we'll get to the movie very soon, but I feel like the movie was produced after the first initial 65 or whatever, and they knew at that point, like, we don't want this character in the movie. We don't like them. They won't be back in the Fox shows.
And they also set a number of shorts that some episodes they varied. Some were full three-act stories, and some were collection of shorts, like either two or three per episode. And the show also set a lot of episodes to music in the kind of classic Schlesinger style of merry melodies. So Sherry Stoner found her niche with Babs, who, when I rewatch these, she's now easily my second favorite character in the show, too. You can't be Plucky. Plucky's my favorite, but second is Babs.
So the last cartoon movie we did for this podcast was Aladdin. And I know the genie was basically a Warner Brothers character in a Disney movie, but all the stuff Babs does, I was like, oh, she's genie. She's just going to change costumes to make a joke about something.
Yeah. And the Babs, like, Sherry Stoner wrote a lot of the top Babs episodes because, as she'd tell it herself, she saw really something of herself in this very funny and manic young girl that, like, loves to be silly, and the world is kind of suppressing her, of just like, now, that's not proper for a lady, or just all these things. Babs suffers a lot for being a woman in comedy quite often.
Yeah.
And everybody just tells her, like, a girl can't do that. Come on.
And on the other side of that, I think Buster just kind of sucks upon watching this movie again. It's like, he thinks he's too cool to be in everything he's in. Mm. He's too much like Bugs. He's not different enough from Bugs.
Well, it's like, Babs got all of the fun, silly dress-ups that Bugs did.
Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, all the rascally rabbit parts of him are in Buster. And so it makes Buster, like, without that wacky costumery to distract you, though not that Buster never dresses up, but it's not like Babs. But more about Sherry Stoner, too, with Babs. Not only did she get through, like, her childhood stories with episodes of Babs being sent to the principal's office, but also clearly influenced by her career in Hollywood, the one where she joins the cast of 13-something.
Right.
And also, if you're a fan of They Might Be Giants, because of this show, you need to thank Sherry Stoner, because she was the fan of They Might Be Giants on the writing staff who said that they should get their songs. So
I'm sure
it's all her.
I'm sure they were fairly notable before that episode aired, but that put them in the minds of everyone who is like 30 to 40 now.
Well, it should also be noted, too, it was commercial synergy. Like, they had Flood, what I think was their first album with Warner, I think.
What a good album.
It's a brand new album for 1990, just like Tiny Toons was a brand new cartoon for 1990. It's a match made in heaven. Meanwhile, Tom Ruger really favored stories that, like, seemingly were influenced on his kids, to the point that one of his kids plays Plucky Duck as a baby in the classic Something Goes Down the Hole.
Yes, and would play Skippy Squirrel.
Sherry Stoner would play Slappy Squirrel to it. Like, and also the character of Byron Bassett in this, partially influenced by Tom Ruger's own dog as well. He tells a story about, like, how, if you remember one bad Furball short, about how Furball keeps trying to eat this bird, and then Byron keeps stopping him from doing it. That's because Tom Ruger's dog protected birds from his cat eating the baby birds. So
I, for some reason, I thought Byron was made up for this movie. I don't remember him from the series at all.
Well, that's a weird gray area in the show, that characters like Fifi are naked animals that walk around, but Byron is a dog. It's not a person. And Furball is kind of treated that way, too. Like, no, you're not a person. But then
Furball's in class.
Sometimes he is. Other times he's starving in a box somewhere. Like, well, it's like, why is Calamity Coyote in class, too? It's like, but that is the difference between it and Animaniacs as well. Animaniacs was the smarter to keep everything as separate sketches for the most part. You know, in musical scenes, they'd hang out together. But in this show, it's like, we all go to Acme University. There's a sitcom-like element of mixing and matching characters because they all go to school together. While meanwhile, like the Warner Brothers and their sister Dot, they are pretty well kept away from the other characters, like Pinky and the Brain.
They'll just walk by in the background so you remember what cartoon
yeah,
you're watching.
Yeah. But also on the writing staff, let's talk again about Paul Dini. He got to go through some of his own passions, especially with the character of Bat Duck, who appeared in multiple episodes, which after 1989, you had to do 800 Batman references everywhere because it was inescapable.
I really love the only new cartoon they made for the Plucky Duck show, which was The Return of Bat Duck.
One of the best ever.
It's so good.
And they timed it to come out right around when the Batman the Animated Series was out and Batman Returns. It was crazy. Like,
it's another TMS one too.
Yes. Watching that, I remember watching Return of Bat Duck and thinking like, this is the greatest Saturday morning of my life.
Could life get better than this?
And on some of those Bat Duck episodes, Paul Dini even worked with some folks named Bruce Timm and Eric Radomski, which would give them some ideas for things that they would pitch in 1991 to Gene McCurdy. Also, as a credit as a writer on many episodes, Jim Reardon. I had forgotten this. Like a lot of the silent ones, like Anvil, the Anvil Orchestra one or whatever, he wrote that one.
Yeah, that's right.
Before leaving for The Simpsons for late season two, I think, maybe season three. As we heard about in our interview with Mark Kirkland, they were on a real hiring boom for season two, and Jim Reardon was probably one of their best hires ever. Like, he's one of their best directors they ever had.
And he is supervising director in the ones we're doing now, right?
Yeah. Which Jim Reardon, like, he's such a overlooked as a story guy too. Like, I think that really comes through in his directed episodes too. Like, he understands execution of jokes and can read this script and then like, I know what's funny about this. I can do it to the utmost. And he did that on some of the best episodes of Tiny Toons as well.
And a few people that would eventually go on to form Spumco.
Yes, yeah. Bob Camp, Betty Fitzgerald, Chris Riccardi.
Yeah.
Dan Haskett also was in there, who he was a name like I didn't know too well until recently. A friend of the show, Thad Komorowski, he pointed out that the amazingly animated scene in the Babysitter Bandit episode with Dan Haskett who did that.
It's great to know that. So Ren and Stimpy co-creator Bob Camp storyboarded 4 episodes. And he is the guy who also storyboarded Stimpy's Invention. And the cartoon is just his boards, as Thad told us. So, just thinking of the amount of talent that was behind the show is crazy.
Yeah, and I think that's why later shows, they get watered down some, just because all the talent was concentrated on Tiny Toons. And thanks to its success, most of those people got hired away to the expanding animation market. Like, Tiny Toons' greatest enemy was a success, really. And then, of course, the voice casting and direction was handled by the irreplaceable living legend Andrea Romano.
Andrea.
And she got a very good cast that included some unexpected folks, but also a lot of toon voiceover lifers, like who you'd hear in everything, like specifically Don Messick and Frank Welker. It feels like Tom Ruger was just like, I want to keep working with those Scooby guys. Let's get Scooby.
I never thought of that.
Freddy,
you're totally right.
Yeah, but in the lead was Charlie Adler, who would quit in the second season because he was very upset he was not cast in Animaniacs.
And this is Bob's cranky corner. The second Buster, John Cassier, he is the guy who played the Crypt Keeper, not Charlie Adler. So only one of the Busters was the Crypt Keeper. I'm sorry. I hear this misinformation everywhere, and I must stop it.
But Charlie Adler is really good as Buster, though I think his best role ever is, I'm not a Cow and Chicken fan, so it's not that.
Ooh,
it's
too much Charlie.
The Big Heads. Yeah,
oh, yes.
Exactly. You can't have 3 Charlie Adlers screaming at each other like that, and maybe Ickes is his best. But
Ickes is the cutest voice he's done.
But I think that's really why I didn't really get into Cow and Chicken, because it's just too much Adler. And he's
Baboon
too.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you can't have him in the other show.
At least you get Michael Dorn?
Yes.
Yeah.
At least you get that. But also on top of Charlie Adler, you got Rob Paulsen, who would take a bigger role in Animaniacs. Cree Summer as Elmira and Mary Melody, the, I believe, first non-horrible African-American Looney Tune character.
I guess
Mary Melody's the only one.
She had a dog character that was the Mark Anthony character. character?
Yes.
Or Mark,
yeah.
Is it Mark Antony or Mark Anthony?
Oh, Mark Antony.
And yeah, Mark yeah. Antony. That is Barky Marky that was like in one cartoon with her.
Yeah, that sucked. I mean, well, Mary Melody didn't have many fun. Like, Elmira's more fun. I think Cree Summer clearly enjoyed playing Elmira more than Mary Melody, too. Like, and also Budnick as Montana Max.
Yeah, Danny Cooksey.
It was a real shocker to me as a child to be like, oh, yeah, it's Yosemite Sam Montana Max.
That
like,
hit me in adulthood. That hit me in adulthood. So, yeah, it was the age of Budnick where it was he was playing Bobby Budnick, Edward Furlong's friend in Terminator 2, and Montana Max, all of them like 3 years.
Well, that was also like a, wait, that's Budnick kind of moment for me, too.
He's got a great raspy voice for a little kid.
He's really a perfect voice. And, of course, I liked any character named Max in things, as you know. But those voice actors are great. But the two I'd really like to spotlight are Tress MacNeille and Joe Alasky.
Oh, yes. R.I.P. Joe Alasky. I think he passed away in 2016.
Yeah, it's sad. But Tress MacNeille, like, she was given maybe the toughest role on the show to be like, oh, you need to be the new Mel Blanc. But for this new girl character, you have to do like eight imitations every episode. You have to constantly sing. You have to play all these different voices. Like there's one classic one where they're flipping through channels and she's like Charlie Brown and then Bart Simpson and then Marge, and she's doing all of them. And like, fortunately, Tress MacNeille is one of the greatest voice actors ever, so she can handle that stuff. Hearing her here, I'm just like, oh yeah, she fucking rules. And she's given so many like thankless roles in stuff because nobody writes good women. Like Babs was one of the first well-written real female characters Tress ever got to play, which gave her a chance to really act out the character. I just love how mercurial Babs is. Like, just she's so fun. You know, when Buster's sad about something, I'm like, oh, that sucks. But when Babs is like, there's no women I could look up to in Looney Tunes, this sucks. Though that episode I had to pretend that Honey was funny.
That's what Honey always was.
Always. And then, of course, there's Joe Lasky.
Oh, boy. Yeah, go back to our Daffy Duck episode of What a Cartoon. We were talking about who replaced Mel Blanc, and they're all good, but I like his the best, even though he's doing a different-ish voice for Plucky, but it's just Daffy Duck variant.
When he's talking with Daffy rarely in the show, you're just like, you sound better than the Daffy voice. Like, I want to hear you be Daffy, which he then graduate to the role after Plucky, but he's like, he gets so much character and fun out. Like, everybody has to scream on the show, but he's the best at it.
Oh, God, he's so good. He's so good. Like, spoilers, the Plucky stuff is the best stuff in this movie. I think a lot of it is because of him. He is just in agony and screaming and excited and delirious. He has to sell all these different extreme emotions, and that pair with the animation is so good. But yeah, Joe Alasky did such a good performance as Plucky and as Daffy later in life.
And Plucky steals the show so much that they just created a fake spinoff that mostly packaged old Plucky Duck cartoons as the Plucky Duck Show. And it was just about how he took it over. And I like Return of Bat Duck is the first original Plucky Duck Show. And it's so great that like Babs and Buster just sit in the background like, I guess we just take this week off then, I suppose. I'm